The Guardian.
We know you all love football, but if you fancy taking a break from the beautiful game, here's an offer you won't want to miss. Right now on Guardian.co.uk, you can watch the award-winning film Skeletons, starring Jason Isaacs, and you can save 10% just for being a listener of Football Weekly. Skeletons is the story of a pair of travelling psychic detectives helping people remove the metaphysical skeletons from their closets. It's eccentric, heartfelt, and very, very funny. The film costs just £3.49 to stream or £5.49 to download. And you can save a further 10% by entering the promotion code SAVEME. To check out the trailer and to find out more, head to guardian.co.uk/skeletons.
Right, hello, welcome to Football Weekly. I am Max Rushton. While James Richardson is away competing in the World's Strongest Man, I am here for three consecutive shows, which will be my longest run in the side, unless, of course, I'm dropped for an over-reliance on Z-list celebrity name drops, too much news about my two-bed mezzanine flats. Nice, Philippe, you'll like it. Or anyone on the panel coolly exposes my lack of knowledge of French football. On today's pod, we will be answering the following questions. How sorry do we all feel for John Terry? Are Liverpool just unlucky? And are Arsenal better than Manchester City? We will also talk to Sid about floodlight failures in Spain. We will give Everton some much-deserved love. And we will answer your best tweeted questions. Right, we have a panel today. Sean Ingle is here. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
You're in some interesting hexagonal footwear.
I am. I twisted my ankle last week. I was running and...
Was it a pavement?
Oh, well, I was running along and there were some little kids on a cycling proficiency thing, so I kind of swerved to avoid them and then stumbled on a pavement that was a bit broken and ended up...
Indicates you run at some pace.
It wasn't badly, sort of 7 minute mile pace, but I was going for a long run.
Okay. Philip Auclair, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Your injury is man flu.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Will you survive?
I will survive. I will sneeze a lot.
You shook hands with Sean and then he ran out to...
Such a wimp.
To use some industrial wipes to cure his hands. Amy Lawrence is here. Hi.
Hello.
And you have a bad back and play the oboe. This is what I've learned in the last 2 minutes.
Well, you're lucky you've only known me for 2 minutes then, hey?
Right, okay, well, we're going to talk John Terry in part two, but we can start with actual football. What a super Sunday it was. I have to say that contractually. We'll start at Anfield. Fortunately, we can talk about football and not chanting or handshakes because pretty much everyone respected everyone else, as you'd hope, if not necessarily expect. Question one, two big decisions. Was it a red card? Sean?
I think it probably was... to be honest, although I don't think Johnny Evans was particularly blameless either, and you could arguably both of them went at it, Ham and Tom, but Shelby was high and did catch a man, and I think it probably was a red card.
I think when you see it, first when you see it at full speed, especially the way Evans, you know, the way he sort of slides, when a footballer is tackled like that and they spin that way, it looked very bad at speed, didn't it?
It looked very bad at slow motion, too. And I completely agree with Sean. I thought it was a red card for Shelby and a yellow for Johnny Evans. But I've never seen that, actually. Can you think of a single example of a so-called 50-50, good old-fashioned challenge in which the two players are actually guilty and in which the referee punishes both? I can't remember a single instance of that.
If we're going to talk about Jonjo Shelvey, and clearly he's quite a favourite of Brendan Rodgers, mm-hmm. And I think he brings a lot to the Liverpool team at the moment. You know, they really need that kind of dynamism and feistiness that he brings to the team. But really, he did take it a little bit too far, and I think his tweets afterwards do need to be mentioned. And I mean, it was pretty amazing stuff to see sort of a little Tyro kind of giving the finger pointing at Alex Ferguson. You can understand that the heat of the emotion of what's been going on recently in Liverpool was perhaps a part of all that. But I think given that Liverpool have had some issues with PR over the last year or so, I don't think it would be so terrible if actually the club came out and didn't show that they were condoning that kind of comment, because I think that, you know, it was that kind of classic childish apology where you say an apology but at the same time manage to insult someone all over again.
Which, it's like his mum had brought him to do the apology.
Exactly.
As well.
It sort of reminded me of my little boy sometimes when he doesn't want to say sorry. So
I suppose sometimes people accuse Sir Alex of things and he is guilty of mind games and things. There's not a lot Sir Alex could have done about that whole incident, is there? I mean, what had he done?
I think he was just complaining. He was not. He was complaining about the other. Manchester United players rather than complaining about Alex Ferguson. Can I just add one thing about what Amy said about Shelby? Mm-hmm. As a player, we've seen what I think one of Steven Gerrard's best performances for a very long time. And I think absolutely essential to that was what Joe Allen and Jonjo Shelvey were doing. So Brendan Rodgers knows his business, and he's starting to put together a very, very fine midfield indeed.
Well, we should give props to Liverpool for the way they played in the first half, certainly until they went down to 10 men. You know, they dominated, particularly in midfield. They looked, you know, the only team that were going to score. And United were strangely off the ball. They have looked like that all season, to be honest, but they keep winning. But what's interesting is if you go back to the start of 2012, Liverpool have only won 20 out of a possible 72 points, which is the second worst behind Aston Villa in the league. So Liverpool keep playing well. They keep having a lot of shots on at goal, but they keep losing. And
even the better side when they went down to 10 men.
I think so. I mean, in the end, it's, you know, it was clearly a very painful day for a lot of different reasons for Liverpool. But there is that feeling that, you know, the season is going to start next weekend at Norwich. And I think that's the way that Liverpool have got to look at it. They've got lots of things going for them at the moment. Obviously, the lack of a regular goal scorer is a real pain. But apart from that, I think that there's no real reason why they can't look at the next few games and get their season back on track.
Yeah, they've got West Brom in the Capital One Cup, Norwich, Stoke and Reading.
Yeah. We have to check out on also the injuries to Martin Kelly and Daniel Lager. If they were to lose both of them for a long period of time, that would be pretty nasty.
Yeah, and Lager was injured in the... I mean, unbelievable that Johnson and Lager couldn't take out Valencia between them in that challenge before the penalty. Was it a penalty?
The Valencia one?
Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
100%?
He clipped him in the box. I mean, it's kind of thing, if it was on the halfway line, you'd have just said, yeah, definitely a foul, just because the area has a penalty, has a higher standard. But yeah, it was a foul.
Do Manchester United need to worry? They're winning games and not playing well. It's a cliche, but...
They should worry about the fact that they haven't got a midfield, which seems to be a common theme in the Premier League at the moment, teams without midfield. I saw one on Saturday at Chelsea. Tottenham had no midfield yesterday against QPR, certainly in the first half. And you could carry on like that. And Manchester United, you looked at the team setup, and you're thinking, well, we don't understand how this is going to work. It's just very dysfunctional. And they were extraordinarily lucky. And it was not one of those things when you say, oh, pugnacious Manchester United fighting back and getting the winner in the 94th minute. No, it was not of that. It was sheer luck.
I think the interesting thing, though, is that you looked around a lot of the message boards when Van Persie arrived, and one of the themes that came out is that Manchester United fans were clearly saying, why buy Van Persie when you really, 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 really need to buy a midfielder or two? And obviously, if they had a certain amount of funds available and that those funds were chosen for Van Persie, you can't really argue with that. But he obviously had a decision to make. Was he going to maybe buy a player to strengthen that midfield area, or was he going to buy the centre forward? And it's difficult because there are goal scorers who are not playing for Man United that much, not getting a lot of minutes. And we can't say whether Hernandez or Welbeck or whatever would be scoring some of the goals that Van Persie has scored this season. But you can't argue with Van Persie, so it's a tricky one.
He's brought in Kagawa, but Kagawa is not a straight midfielder. He likes to play him just off the shoulder of the main striker. Actually, when they were playing 11v11, Van Persie, the kind of service he got was abysmal. The midfield just couldn't get any vertical pass going. They were not covering the space well. And I looked at the stats for the first half. He touched the ball 5 times, Van Persie, not once in the 30 yards. And every single one of the balls he got, he had to pass backwards. So they couldn't bring him in. They have this incredible attacking talent, but... obviously not the players to organise the play from midfield, apart from Paul Scholes, which is really an admission of defeat.
So we need to worry a bit about Man United. Do we worry about Man City as well, looking at the Arsenal game? Arsenal were far, far better, weren't they, than Man City?
I'm not sure about far, far better. I thought it was a fairly even game. Man City weren't as good as you expect them to be when they're at their peak. Arsenal were clearly much improved, I think, than they were a year ago. They're looking at really solid at the moment, and it says a lot that the goal they give away was something that they'll feel really disappointed about, whereas instead of it just being, oh, there's a typical Arsenal goal that they've given away, there's a slightly different mentality now. But, you know, I think there were two or three occasions where Aguero could easily have won it for Man City. And then we wouldn't be having that conversation about whether you'd be worried about them at all. And Arsenal equally had good chances to win it, but, well, sort of semi-chances, because they mainly fell to Jorginho, who was having a kind of old-school Jorginho day rather than a...
I quite like it. I mean, I would say, so he's a, you know, when the commentators say, well, he's a willing runner and he'll give you everything, it's not really enough, I guess, for a Premier League striker. But
well, he's not really a striker. So, I mean, this is a very new thing for him. And I think you have to cut him some slight slack. And Wenger last week said, oh, well, I mean, you know, Teehee, we always turn our wingers into strikers. And sounded awfully clever when he scored a couple of goals and had a great game against Southampton at home. But it's not something that's going to happen overnight. And I'm not sure whether he's got that kind of clinical edge to him.
I'm aware I'm sounding like my dad when I say this, but given they... Walcott, given Jorginho have an awful lot of time practicing shooting balls into a goal, it can't be that difficult, surely, to be a little bit more precise.
You do sound like your dad.
I know.
But I don't even know your dad.
But it's that thing you can't teach, because everybody can, every footballer can play a 10-yard pass, well, pretty much. But then when that 10-yard pass is into the bottom corner, it's just a totally different thing, isn't it?
True, but I'm not an Arsenal fan by any means. But every time the ball comes to Walcott or Jorginho in the box, I'm thinking, they're going to, I'm not sure Amy gets that.
But Podolski was someone who, you know, has obviously had a lot of praise recently, and I think Steve Bould called him in the week that one of the best finishers he'd seen ever, which is, you know, fairly high praise. And he had a chance, which he ballooned in the style of Jorginho also, albeit with his wrong foot, but, you know, it's not that straightforward. And they're a team that are evolving, and they're evolving really well, and there's a lot of positives. And I think one who doesn't get a lot of mention, but who was absolutely outstanding, was Mikel Arteta. And the way he's reinvented himself from a slightly more attacking player to a sort of Makalele style midfielder who seems to be aware of absolutely everything that's happening, he's incredibly impressive.
I mean, I don't want to get carried away. I mean, I thought Arsenal were very good yesterday.
Get carried away.
But it's worth pointing out that they had the third best away record in the Premier League last season. I mean, everyone remembers the 8-2 shellacking. Everyone thinks that Arsenal are brittle, and they certainly were on many occasions last season. But they still end up with a third best away record. So doing what they're doing, beating Liverpool away, a good draw at City is, I think, a step in the right direction, but we shouldn't necessarily go overboard. It's a shame, though, they haven't kept Robin van Persie, because that team needs someone that can score 25 goals a season.
You say that. On the other hand, I think of the recent years at Arsenal, the best one was when, just after Thierry Henry left, 2007-2008, when it was an absolutely magnificent Arsenal team. And I think in terms of the quality of the play, perhaps the best I've ever seen in terms of pure beauty of the play, if not the quality of the squad, you know, not the 2003-2004 side, of course. But what perhaps will have surprised people, remember the clamour there was for Arsene Wenger to sign Yann Mvila. Mm-hmm. You know, the famous transfer that was done and dusted in May? Yeah, yep. Right. You look at their midfield. I was talking about midfield-less team.
Cazorla was unreal.
Arsenal has got a magnificent midfield this season because it's really strengthened depth as well. We saw Ramsey coming in yesterday and having his best game for a very, very long time indeed. Rosy Key is going to come back. Francis Coquelin is a very promising player. Diaby seems to be running on his two legs. Which is amazing.
Which is in training, apparently.
And the balance is really great.
Cazorla's 16 million, which is the same as Jordan Henderson. I know Jordan Henderson gets, you know, he's always compared when someone's a lot of money, but I thought that's the first time I've seen Cazorla really dominate a game.
No. If you watched him in Malaga last season, he was brilliant as well.
There is the first time I'd seen him dominate a game.
I think you don't get 43 or 44 caps for Spain as they are now.
Yeah.
With the kind of competition there is, without being a pretty good player.
But that's a bargain, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's not even 16 million. That'll be if all the various add-ons come in. It's more like around about 13, 14, and I think Henderson was slightly more than 16. So, you know, when you're putting those kind of comparisons in, which you say are a little bit unfair because there's the classic English football tax, but he's an absolute steal.
Stuart Downing at some point as well.
Let's talk about Man City for a sec. I mean, I really thought, I mean, you'd say that it was an even game, but still, Man City, does Mancini know his best formation, his best team? Why does everyone look
silence
at me?
Where do you want to start?
At the beginning.
First of all, the recruitment this summer was baffling.
Yeah.
Because I can't think of... I don't think Javi Garcia is as good as people say he is. I don't think he's as good anywhere as good as Nigel de Jong. Was a player I really rated very highly, but there you go. There seems to be more discontent again. As to the system, I mean, the one thing that really is surprising is that how can a team that was the best, had the best defensive record last season, become a team that has leaked something like 10 goals since the beginning of the season, not counting the Community Shield? So I think it's 7 in the league plus the 3 at Real Madrid. So they still have to keep a clean sheet this season, which seems quite astonishing, really.
Any reason?
Is it? Well, it shows that, again, there is an imbalance in that team. It shows that he hasn't found the means to protect his back four. He's got one of the best keepers in England. We all agree with that. He's got one of the best centre-backs in England, perhaps in Europe, Vincent Kompany. He's got some full-backs who are also pretty decent. Excuse me, but Zabaleta is a hell of a player. And Lescott is supposed to be a regular in the England team. And you carry on, and Kolarov, and Clichy, and Nastasic, who's just come in. You're wondering. And Yaya Toure, who is a beast.
But you can't underestimate, it's a massive cliche or stereotype, but the difficulty of defending a title. And, you know, when you've got it in front of you to try and win it for the first time, you've got that incentive and that hunger and that desperation, which they obviously had in spades last season. It is difficult to replicate that as far as the adrenaline is concerned. You know, when you're already the winner and the one to be shot out, it's, you know, it underlines just what Man United have done over these last few years to do it again.
That's desire, and I don't know whether it's desire is the problem. If not, I think it's more organisation and more just doing the simple things well. And City, you know, conceding silly goals. There's been a lot of mistakes, which is very unlike them this season.
Can we hope then, if Man United and Man City aren't playing that well, that we will have the ultimate last day of the season when there's 4 or 5 teams that could win the league? In a word.
I would love Everton to be up there, because I think Everton are playing wonderful stuff. I'd love Arsenal to be up there. I'd love just something different, because ever since Sky come along, they've done a lot of good things. But we do get
many great things.
Implore you. But you know, it would be nice to have a little bit of change at the top. But we all know that, you know, it's going to be the same 3 teams battling out come March, April, May.
Sure. Well, look, we will give more love to Everton in part 2 or part 3. I can't remember. But in part 2, John Terry, captain, leader, legend, and much more. Hello, welcome to part 2, which is just after part 1. We will round up the Premier League in a minute. But first, every front page is a picture of John Terry. Last night, he retired from international football. This is the key sentence from the... it's not on the front page of the Times 2, which is what, Philippe? Sexist or sexiest?
The Crazy Horse Girls.
Oh, who are they?
Yeah, I'll show it to you in a minute.
Oh, okay, right.
To John Terry.
Okay, we'll talk about John Terry, then we'll talk about French women dressed as soldiers in bikinis, which is potentially more interesting.
You call that a bikini?
Was it? It's a soldier bikini, is
yes,
it?
Yes, sort of, yes.
Burlesque style. Mm-hmm. Never really understood burlesque. Anyway, right, here's the key moment, the key sentence from JT's statement then. He says, I feel the FA in pursuing charges against me where I have already been cleared in a court of law have made my position with the national team untenable. And he goes on to say, it breaks my heart to make this decision. The FA this morning, this is Alex Horn, the General Secretary of the FA, is mystified by JT's decision. He says, it's a personal decision. I don't see how we've made it untenable. They're two very separate processes. What do we make of the timing of this, Sean?
Well, given if you're up before the FA on charges like this, you're normally guilty. It's a bit like kind of being in North Korea or kind of, you know, you generally, if the FA charge you this sort of thing, you know, you generally go down. I guess the key difference is there is a different burden of proof with a criminal court and the FA. With the criminal court, it's beyond reasonable doubt. With the FA, it will be on the balance of probabilities that he said what he said. And given that he has admitted calling Anton Ferdinand what he did, there's much more likelihood that he will be found guilty.
Amy?
Well, I just think you can't underestimate how much this whole thing is slightly brought upon himself, just purely in terms of the advice that he received. And I think you can really trace a lot of this back to when he was originally supposed to be having his trial, and there was the really bizarrely timed, and we talk about timing, announcement or appeal from him to get this investigation, the police trial, postponed till after the Euros. And that was the trigger that then led to Capello's departure and to this whole affair taking an entirely different complexion, because it affected things far beyond him, Anton Ferdinand, and what actually happened and took place and how it was regarded by the wider world. You know, that was a mistake. And if he'd have got his trial done and dusted beforehand, before the Euro's been cleared. This whole thing could have been dealt with far, far earlier. It's dragged on for an absolute eternity. But I think the other thing to bear in mind is that when footballers quit, when they're still perfectly able to play international football, maybe John Terry's reasoning is absolutely justified, and he feels very much that his position has been made untenable, and that's that. But sometimes there are other factors at work. You have to ask yourself, there's been some great players who have stopped playing international football when they still can. Zidane, Andrea Pirlo recently. There's no earthly reason why they weren't still playing at the time when they decided not to. And once players hit 30-something, they've been playing a lot of football all their lives. When international football, the schedule is very demanding. For the next 2 years, if you're John Terry, do you really want to be travelling around to, you know, we go, oh, places like Moldova. But you know what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. It's not a lot of fun. It's not as much fun as people seem to make out when they're actually, you know, on long journeys, and they get fed up and they're bored in their hotels and they don't really know what they want to do.
I think sometimes
this could be a little bit that he does. He really want to do this for another 2 years, and then looking at Brazil in the World Cup, he's had experience of tournaments that have ended up with a lot of recrimination, with tears. It's all been terribly tragic, and it's, you know, very upsetting and difficult to take. Does he want to experience that, or has he had enough?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I was chatting to a player who has retired, and he kind of agreed with this idea that actually, obviously, if you're not a footballer like any of us, the thought of playing in a World Cup is so exciting. I just can't imagine anything better. But if you're a footballer and you've done it, at the end of playing football all year, do you want to go and play some more football? Or do you want to sit on a beach?
And go out on penalties and get a load of stick from everybody, which is what tends to happen.
Yes, I don't want to waffle too much about the John Terry case. What depresses me is that it's the front page in every paper I've seen this morning. I would have preferred to see a picture of Bobby Charlton laying a wreath of 96 roses in the centre of Anfield. That's where the real action happened. That's why I'm concerned, but there you go. He set his own agenda, and he succeeded in setting the agenda. Was that a good idea to set his own agenda? I'm not so sure about that. I'll just make one point, is that I get what Amy is saying, but I'm very old-fashioned when it comes to representing your own country, and I do think that the decision to retire should be entirely left to the FA, which gives you your license to play. Mm-hmm. And the idea that a player can decide, even for the best of reasons. I mean, for example, when Paul Scholes retired, I could really understand why he retired, because he had been treated like, honestly, a little piece of a Subotio player, which you could put here and there and then, when the whole team should have been built around him. But maybe the idea that a player has the right to retire is something that could be addressed. I don't know. I'm not absolutely sure it's valid.
I mean, I looked
at the decision. You know, in a way, he's taking the decision away from his federation, his manager. Is that right? I'll leave you to decide.
I looked for some sympathetic comments towards JT. Couldn't even find any on the Daily Mail website, actually. Daniel Taylor's written a very good piece on The Guardian, and that's got some interesting comments. I'm very wary of saying, and a lot of people have said, ignoring everything off the pitch, because you shouldn't just ignore an accusation of racism. But ignoring it, he has been one of the best centre-backs for England, has he not?
Well, I think we should make that point. He, you know, at his peak, and I think he's a fair way from his peak now, he was a classic English centre-half. He was strong, he was determined, he was a leader of men. But I don't think he's the player he was. And I think he also brings baggage with him. When you have someone like, you know, John Terry, or JT as you matily call him, in the dressing room, you know, because I think you either, you know, he divides people.
Sure.
You either for, you know, for him or against him.
But who is there to?
I mean, why would you call him JT? By the way, are you kind of? Good,
I don't know.
Good mate?
I've no idea. I've never met him, so I just what you read, isn't it? I'll call him John Terry for now, whichever you'd prefer. I don't mind. I don't call Trevor Nelson TN, so maybe...
I think he's a player who's played in the wrong era. If he'd have been playing in the 70s and 80s, he probably would have had a quite different career in terms of the way he's perceived.
But he's better on the ball than people give him credit.
No, I'm not talking about his playing style. I'm talking about the environment, of the football environment. I think he probably could have behaved more or less as he's behaved throughout his career, and everybody would have thought good old John Terry, whereas in these days people don't think that.
As a player,
are we enlightened?
Just to steer well clear of all controversy,
yeah,
and to start another one, I think he was, if we talked about him in the past, overrated as a defender and gravely underrated as a footballer. I think he's got one of the best distribution as of a centre-half I can remember in this country, and I include all foreign players in that. Absolutely magnificent distribution. Can hit 50, 60-yard passes and hit them really well. Not Hollywood passes, as they say. And they were not hoofs in the general direction of the target, but they were genuine passes. Very, very good distributor of the ball. Problem, because of his lack of pace, which always has been a problem and is ever more a problem, obviously, you cannot defend very high with a player like that. Right. Which means that, in a way, also he would have fitted maybe in another era better than he fits now, in as much people defending deeper. If you want to have a high defensive line, having somebody like John Terry, you really need to have somebody who is really quick of mind and of foot, you know, Ricardo Carvalho at his best, to cover for yourself. And then you can say, yes, when you team up John Terry with William Gallas, for example, or with Ricardo Carvalho, those combinations, absolutely magnificent. Actually, they're probably two of the best in Europe at the time when they were in their prime, those guys. But as an individual central defender, I think we tend to overrate a little bit the heroic last-ditch defending, when, honestly, a great central defender shouldn't do that. Yeah. You know, Franco Baresi didn't do that.
That's Franco Baresi, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly, but that's a great central defender.
Amy.
But you're comparing, you know, Camembert with Parmesan. You know, they're two different things, surely.
I thought you were going to say, you know, Laughing Cow or, you know, Derry Lee.
Two very fine things, Camembert and Parmesan, in their own way.
Let's talk about Chelsea on the pitch. You were at the game, the Stoke game?
Yeah, I was at the game.
Were they?
I've seen actually every Chelsea game this season, for some strange reason. They're top of the league. You can't argue with that, is the saying. They're undefeated. They might have been a little bit unlucky, or a bit lucky, against Juve in the Champions League. So you look at it, you think, well, he's not doing too badly, is he? But on the other hand, on the pitch itself, there are loads of holes in that team. It still looks completely dysfunctional to me.
Do we have a Premier League problem where City, United and Chelsea all seem to have...
No, but that's why I was saying they're midfield-less. There's no midfield in Chelsea.
But they've got a lot of midfielders.
Not number tens.
They've got Eden Hazard. They played Hazard, Mata, Oscar, Mata with Torres, poor Torres, who was on a different planet playing for a different team in a different league, up front. And then they had Ramirez, who is not exactly what I would qualify as a holding midfielder, and John Obi Mikel, who is a converted number 10. People have been trying to convert him into a defensive midfielder, but he's not. And so the team had no shape, and Stoke were clearly, for me, the better side for a long, long period of the game, despite, you know, some really exquisite movement up front from Chelsea. But I'm worried because there is absolutely nobody to pick on the bench or in the reserves since Essien has gone and he's now playing for Real Madrid, and Raul Mareles, which my flabber is ghasted. Why did they let him go? There's nobody to replace him. Yeah. Oriol Romeu, who seems on the bench and he stays there.
What did you make of Tony Pulis afterwards? He seemed to make some valid points about Chelsea diving and David Luiz's challenge as well.
Well, this thing about the simulation, and I'm not going to endear myself to Stoke fans, this won't be the first time. I find that Tony Pulis really laid it on very, very thick indeed. I was in the room when he arrived and he did his press conference standing as he tends to do, and made basically an address about simulation and telling us it was all those dirty foreign players and it shouldn't be like this, and they've brought it into the game. And I'm really sick and tired of hearing that. Absolutely sick and tired. And also because, yes, it's true that some of the behaviour of some of the Chelsea players, Ivanovic in particular, was not great. But it's something that's becoming a theme at the moment. And there's one thing which should be... But perhaps people should remember one thing. When a player falls in the box, it's not necessarily because there is a foul or because there is a dive. You can have genuine, legitimate contact and a player falls. You can have a player who clips his own heels and, because of his impetus, falls. This is not necessarily simulation.
What does it mean for the Premier League, then, if the best three sides don't have a midfield between them? Apart from Yaya Touré.
Yeah, absolutely. It means that they are all work in progress in different ways. And probably the most surprising one to be a work in progress is City, because, you know, they should be a little bit best equipped to carry on where they left off last season. United probably did have some changes to make, which are slowly being integrated. And Chelsea have clearly embarked on a very new approach, which they're trying to introduce a more aesthetic beauty to the way that they play, which is totally laudable, and it's going to take them a while to do that. But that question of balance is the thing that's most difficult to find, because it's all very well bringing in technical gifted players, but you can't just chuck them in there and expect, especially in a league as combative as the Premier League, for everything to just, you know, go hunky dory without practice. First of all, they've got to come together, but also some kind of balance.
And at the moment, to me, there are only two so-called top teams which have this kind of balance, and they're Arsenal and Everton.
Okay, let's talk about Everton then. What?
With great pleasure.
Okay, go.
Well, I think I'm thrilled.
there was a double fist pump there.
No, I mean, I've been. It's something we've been waiting for so long. It's not just the fact that they have their best start to the season since the season when they pipped Liverpool to place in the Champions League. It seems like David Moyes has unleashed his players at long last. He's done this thing of having a team that has remarkable work ethic, remarkable humility, excellent organisation, some very fine individuals, etc., etc. But it's turned it into a genuinely wonderful sight to watch. And I must say the show at Swansea was just absolutely magnificent. I was jumping on my chair. 31 attempts at goal away from home, an all-time record by Everton.
Huge credit to Moyes for... You take Stephen Pienaar, you would have just thought any player who... That kind of player should really excel at Spurs, and it's a sign that Moyes has some real quality to make someone like that look like a different player. Well, playing him helps, obviously.
Yeah, I'm told that he was absolutely insistent that of the various things that they did this summer, getting Stephen Pienaar back for good was absolutely fundamental. They're playing it. In a way, what's interesting about Everton is they look like they've got more strength and depth. I don't know whether that's just a trick of the eye, but you know, you always had the feeling with Everton that on their day they had a first 11 when they were clicking to have a game with anybody. But it feels now that they've got slightly more options and slightly more strength.
They're only missing Jelovic from their best side.
And they're still scoring lots of goals. I think it's going to be fascinating to see. The fact they've even had a good start in itself is a massive change for Everton compared to recent seasons. So it's going to be really, really intriguing to see how long they can sustain it for.
And, of course, they're not playing in Europe.
Which always helps.
It helps an awful lot.
But even still, do they have the depth? I mean, that's the fear, isn't it?
Will they have the luck? They were not very lucky with Jelovic. But they've been... I mean, again, their recruitment has been excellent. Kevin Miralas seems to have immediately found his place in the team. And it's not one of those teams where I would imagine, okay, of course, if they were to lose Marouane Fellaini for a length of time, that would be hamper them a lot. But at the back, they're covered, you know. I mean, Sylvain Distin was on the bench, you know, at Swansea, who is not exactly a bad defender. You don't want to get carried away. But it's a team, I think, that everybody would absolutely love to see do well this season at long last.
Isn't there a feeling that they've really got to strike while the iron's hot? Because you know with Everton, because of their financial situation, that, you know, there's always the potential for somebody to be picked off. There's, you know, usually a case where a player gets sold in a transfer window. You know, and they keep recovering from that situation.
They recover because people thought, like, Rodwell was the great prospect. They thought, oh, that's going to leave a hole in their midfield. No, actually, it hasn't. They seem to be able to carry on, and they've created impetus, and obviously there is also... and they haven't lost any of their traditional virtues, which are also quite admirable.
Right, this is part three of Football Weekly. We have to be very quick because Philippe is in a hurry. Let's start in Spain and say hello to Sid Lowe. Sid, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, very well. You all right?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you.
Okay, so let's talk about La Liga. Real Madrid's match at Rayo Vallecano was postponed after sabotage. Someone cut the floodlight cables, did they?
Well, this is what they say. This is what they say, Rayo Vallecano. I did the double header last night. Went to Atletico Madrid at 6 o'clock, and then Rayo Vallecano against Real Madrid across the south of the city at 9:30. Came out of the metro at 9 o'clock and thought, it's very strange. There's people in the streets and all the doors are shut, and it was weird atmosphere because it was kind of silent and very still, and people weren't particularly complaining. They were just kind of standing there waiting. And then it emerged that the floodlights had failed, and they suggested that this was the reason why they weren't letting the fans into the stadium, because it was dark and it was dangerous to let them into the stadium, although there was some light within the inside. Then later there was a suggestion that the same electricity that powered the floodlights had meant that the turnstiles weren't working. And then what happened in the midst of all this kind of uncertainty was that the president of Raya Vallecano said that this is sabotage. Cables don't cut themselves.
They
and Raya Vallecano even published a photograph of like a cable box with a blue cable cut.
Wow, that's great. And it's a shame it wasn't mid-game, because that's one of the greatest cheers in football when the floodlights go out. And everyone cheers, and then a minute later they go, oh, we didn't really want to cheer that because now there's no game. So what's going to happen with this match then?
Well, they're now saying that they're going to play it today, but there's been arguments about when they play it. The police are still down at the stadium now trying to investigate what happened, because, of course, if this is a sabotage, then it becomes a criminal. And the delegate of the government last night was saying that, you know, she wanted to be cautious about this and not necessarily declare it as a sabotage, because there was no direct evidence of that as yet. And there's some suggestions from a few suspicious-minded people suggesting that maybe Raya Vallecano were trying to cover their own backs by pretending it was a sabotage, because no one took responsibility for this. It's going to kick off tonight at 7:45, which is pretty bad news for Michael Essien, because he's supposed to be getting married today, apparently.
What? So has he said what he's going to do? Would you have the ceremony and then play, and then maybe do the speeches at half time?
I'm not even sure that he was due to get married in Spain.
He's due to get married in England.
Are you so, going, right. Sean? No.
Me and Michael aren't as close as you and JT, obviously. Right. But no, I read that earlier in the week. He's due to get married somewhere in England today.
Yeah, so that's either really screwed his plans or he doesn't play for Real Madrid today. So he must be particularly pissed off.
What time is the kickoff, Sid?
Kickoff was 9:30. But bear in mind, in all of this, and I think this is almost the most important thing, in all of this, the fans were outside the stadium, not knowing what was going on. And the most they got was a few PA announcements saying, please remain calm, we're trying to decide, you know, the game is currently put back for the time being, and we're trying to decide what we do next. Then at one stage, when the final announcement was made, this game is off. That was 10:18. This is, in other words, 48 minutes after it was due to start. It's the first time the fans waiting outside were told, it is off, go home. Some of the fans were angry, although they've been told that they will get their money back, those that aren't able to go tonight and had tickets last night. The problem is, of course, that can't go tonight. There isn't any mechanism now to resell those tickets. And it's going to be tonight at 7:45. And even that caused an argument, because Madrid won it at 5 o'clock when it's still daylight. Because they're saying, well, what's the guarantee that your lights are going to work tonight?
Is it simply a case of someone has forgot to put the money in the meter?
They tried switching it on and off again, yeah.
Or is it no, the case that nobody has the money to put be, in the meter?
What it could be is, there's a suggestion from some. It really, winter started yesterday. Madrid's amazing. Madrid goes from summer to winter in one day. You know, really, the summer, one day, summer just stops, normally at the end of September, early in October. And yesterday, it just started pouring down with rain about 8 o'clock. And there was a suggestion from some of the journalists that were already inside the ground in Vallecano, that they saw kind of a poof, and a bit of a spark, and some of the lights go out. And the suggestion was maybe the rains provoked this. But we don't know if it's a sabotage or not, but it could be that Raya are trying to cover their backs. As I say, they did publish a photo of a cable cut, but then, of course, you know...
Could have been anyone.
...say that cable cut was... And it's a pretty serious job, by the way. That's the other thing. If this is a sabotage, they said that 25 of these cable boxes were cut. So in other words, someone's got in the stadium to a sensitive part of the stadium and being able to cut 25 cable boxes, get into 25 cable boxes, 25 blue cables, and sabotage the game. So then you have to ask yourself, is that possible? And also, why would they do it? Well, perhaps because it was Dia del Club, which is that criminal policy where some clubs make even their season ticket holders pay when the big boys turn up.
Maybe it was either Sergio Ramos, because he's angry with not playing, or it was Essien, because he wanted all his...
team, so it was a real cock-up from Ramos if it had been
him. You seem to have another question about Essien's wedding.
Yeah, I'm a little bit perplexed about Essien's wedding, because if it was a 9:30 kick-off, then, you know, they're not going to be finished till about 11:30, and they've got to get changed and showered, and they might have to do a urine sample, drug test. You know, not going to get out of the ground, not going to get home till what, 1 o'clock in the morning, in a different country to the place you're getting married the next day.
One thing I'll say is, I would imagine that Essien's wedding has been arranged for some time.
But you've got three and months, he's you've got only three been at Ra-
and he's only been at Real Madrid for a month, not even that. So the chances are he, A, assumed that he would be playing in England, where kickoff times are not the same, and also where kickoff times, they have a fun habit in England of telling you when kickoff times are, which doesn't happen in Spain.
Do we?
Because, for example, he could have been playing tonight under a normal, you know, he could have been playing on Monday night, not because of a floodlight failure, but because the league told him to play on Monday night, and he wouldn't have known that until 7 days ago anyway.
Do we know the first dance at the Essien wedding?
Something slow.
I don't know that we do.
Is there anyone who didn't want Essien to get married, which is why the sabotage is...
Well, is there a legal reason? They'll say in the ceremony.
There's a really big issue with Essien's wedding and this whole issue now. If Essien's getting married today, Essien, when he turned up at Real Madrid, with a massive big smile and very, very pleased about this, told everybody that Jose Mourinho was his dad. So presumably Mourinho's got to go to the wedding as well.
This is great, isn't it? Well, look, I think by Thursday, Sid, can you just find out as much as you can about the SEN? We'll do what we can this side.
Well, I mean, he's in your territory, not mine, so maybe I should leave it to you.
We'll try and find the meal and the first
dance. Do you think John Terry's going, by the way?
Who knows? Well, I don't have JT's number, sadly, but I know a man who does, so I'll see what I can do. And we'll try and find out as much information about the SEN wedding as we possibly can. Let's talk about football for a little bit. Barcelona left it very late, didn't they? I saw a little bit of this. I was on a date in Cafe Kick, Sid, which went okay. But, you know, I don't think there's a future in it. But you presumably watched the game. Tell us about it.
Barcelona were very, very poor in the first half. They created a couple of half chances, but were very poor. Second half, when Xavi came on, created more, but they were being... Tonio kept on saving everything they threw at him, and Barcelona left it very late, and they really weren't particularly impressive. Xavi scored the goal that settled the nerves, and then own goal made it 2-0, I think, from like the 89th minute. Xavi's goal must have been around about the 85th, the 86th, and Barcelona looked really nervous. And this is a team now that's won 5 out of 5. They're temporarily, while we wait for the Real Madrid game, 11 points clear of Real Madrid already. But that perfect start in terms of points, it hasn't been a perfect start at all in terms of play with Barcelona this season, and they're not entirely convincing just yet.
Very quickly, Sid, we were talking about how good Carzola's been for Arsenal. Is there any surprise in Spain that he didn't go to Barca or Real?
No, not really. What there is a certain degree of indignation about the fact that he didn't go to Barcelona or Real Madrid, a frustration that a player this good has been allowed to leave. Not so much from the Barcelona point of view, because I think if you look at the Barcelona midfield, Xavi, Busquets, Iniesta, you say, well, Cazorla doesn't really get in there, however good he is. Well, personally, I would put him in that midfield. I'd put him in any midfield. There's a certain degree of frustration that Real Madrid didn't go for him when you bear in mind that he cost half as much as Modric did, when he cost half as much as for example, Coen Trau did. So there is a sense that it's a pity that a Spanish player of that kind of talent wasn't signed by Real Madrid. Madrid did try and sign him a few years ago when Ramon Calderon was the president, not the current one, Florentino Perez, and that collapsed at the last minute, a deal from Villarreal. So I think there's a little bit of irritation, but perhaps not so much surprise because of the specifics of the situation. And it makes me laugh a bit when people say, when Cazorla first joined for Arsenal, he can't be that good because Madrid or Barcelona would have bought him. Well, Barcelona, where do you put him in? Because they've got the very, very best midfielders in the world. And Madrid did try to. I just think Cazorla is a brilliant player.
Right, let's talk about France. Philippe, talk to me.
Hello?
Hello. Right, first of all, Marseille are top.
Yeah.
1-0 win against Evian, 100% record, haven't conceded a goal. Is this all down to Joey Barton?
No.
Is there
no, because he's suspended. Don't forget that. it's a big surprise, I must say, because people were expecting when Didier Deschamps, even though the presence of Didier Deschamps in his very conflictual relationship with José Anigo, the sports director in particular, was held responsible in part for the fact that Marseille had really struggled last season. And the fact, you know, Elie Boop, nobody thought, well, he's the solution to everything. But on the other hand, their record has been absolutely tremendous. Even though they suffered this time around, they suffered. They were very close to concede their first 2 points. How long it's going to last, I don't know. They managed to hold on to most of the players who were supposed to go. Remember, Loïc Rémy was talked about going everywhere. Jordan Ayew was talked about going everywhere. And Kulu as well. I mean, loads of players who were supposed to go have stayed. And obviously, the atmosphere at the club is much better. I don't think they quite have the resources to stick for the whole duration. It will be PSG, and that will be that.
PSG up to third. They walloped Bastia 4-0.
Walloped. And,
walloped.
Yeah, absolutely walloped. And they're starting walloping people, and I think they'll start doing that regularly with Zlatan in supreme form again for PSG. I know people in France are incensed at the amount of money he's getting, but
what is he getting?
We're talking 12 million net of tax. Oh. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, solid.
And but I could add the wages of some of his teammates and put them together, and you know, those two or three guys are not half as good as he is on his own. No, he's been absolutely amazing. And the other one who's been absolutely superb for PSG, and perhaps we were not expecting that, is Verratti, who was taken from Pescara and immediately settled in the team, whereas everybody else still looks like pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. Well, yeah, pieces looking for their spot in a jigsaw puzzle. Suddenly starting to take shape, and you know, that what we thought would happen a bit more quickly is starting to happen now. Ancelotti is starting to find a shape to that team. They're going to wallop everybody inside. I have absolutely no doubt about it. They're so far superior to everybody.
Producer Ben has given me a stat, a quote from Ibrahimovic, who says he doesn't understand all the complaints about how much he earns because it just means the French are getting more money in tax.
Yeah, fair enough. I've absolutely no problem. I really haven't got a problem with Zlatan's wages. I've got a problem with the wages of some other PSG players who are getting absolute fortunes and who are not worth it. But he's in the particular situation that French football finds itself in, where it has to offer huge financial incentives to players to play there. It makes sense when you have a true world-class player like Zlatan Ibrahimovic, and he is a world-class player. It makes sense to pay him a lot of money.
Sean, sure, you have a question. That.
Very quickly, PSG, what do you make of their Champions League prospects this season? Any chance they could
surprise me? Yes, go far? No, I don't think so. I thought that at the beginning when I saw the group, and I know they think they've got an easy group, I thought it's going to be tough for them, but I was quite impressed by their display against Kiev. Suddenly it seems to have clicked. And if it clicks in Europe, the thing is that they've got the squad to rotate. They've got the squad to play two competitions at the same time. And yes, they were not too unlucky in the draw, were they? They could have been an absolutely appalling group. And they're not.
Right. Well, that's enough for today. Sean, thank you.
Thank you.
Philippe, thank you.
Thank you.
Amy, thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck with all your respective injuries and illnesses. And keep washing your hands. Sean. On Thursday, Barry is here, so I will come, as this tweet asked, for celebrity stories and how my flat decorating is coming along. And Rafa is with us as well. We'll see you on Thursday. Cheers.